Now call on our brother Dan as he speaks to the subject, the crown of glory in the hand of Yahweh.
Well, good evening, my dear brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and young people. You may recall that we've recently moved into a section of Isaiah and we've met a new character there. He's the anointed conqueror, so we've termed him. And this anointed conqueror gives four songs in a section from Isaiah 59 to Isaiah 63. And tonight, it's our turn to look at the third of these songs of the anointed conqueror. You may wonder why we started in verse 10 of chapter 61. Well, it's simply because that's where the third of these songs begins, and it goes right through chapter 62 to the ending verse, verse 12. So let's begin at chapter 61, verse 10, where we meet this anointed conqueror in a jubilant mood. He says, "I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God." So here he is, and he's rejoicing. He's very joyful. But why? What is the reason for this rejoicing? I just want to put that question to one side for the moment, because there's some important background work to do first, because I believe in verse 10 here we have portrayed the character of the high priest of Israel himself. Think back 2 weeks ago to the last class. Do you remember we looked up Leviticus 8? No need to turn there now. And there were three elements that we saw there pertaining to the priest and to the high priest at their consecration. The first one, they were anointed with oil, this oil upon their heads. The second, they were given special garments to wear. And the third, a mitre or the priestly headdress was set upon their head. So there are those three things. And all of those three things are there in verse 10. We saw them in verse 3 of chapter 61 last time. But here in verse 10, he says, "I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robe of righteousness." So there's the first of them, the special garments, garments of salvation, a robe of righteousness, as it's termed in verse 10. Read on in the verse, and we see another of these things. "As a bridegroom decketh himself with ornaments," if you look in your centre margin, "as a bridegroom decketh as a priest." The word ornaments refers to the headdress which the high priest of Israel wore, and also his sons the priests. So there's the second thing. What about the oil? We don't seem to see the oil in verse 10. Just compare with verse 3, where those three things are again given. "To appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty for ashes." Beauty is the same word for this high priest headdress. "The oil of joy for mourning." So there's the oil in verse 3, and it's the oil of joy. Compare that with verse 10. Where's the oil in verse 10? The oil of joy, verse 3. Verse 10, "I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God." And also, verse 1 of chapter 61. "The spirit of Adonai Yahweh is upon me, because Yahweh hath anointed me." So all the three things there pertaining to the priest and the high priest, they're present in verse 10. And I'm suggesting that behind verse 10, we see the image, the figure of the high priest of Israel. So why is this anointing one rejoicing? We now have a clue to answer this question. "I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God." Why? "For he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robe of righteousness." So why is he joyful? Because God has appointed him to be high priest of his people. He's the one who is going to bring salvation to his people, and he takes great delight and joy in being given that role by God. These are his feelings as he takes on his role pertaining to our salvation. He feels great joy in bringing that saving work so that each of us may find a place in God's kingdom. He's delighted to take that work upon him. For he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robe of righteousness, says the verse. What does it mean to be clothed with the garments of salvation? I just want you to visualize in your minds for a moment the consecration of the high priest in Israel. As they would have gathered there around the tabernacle, all of the people around the tabernacle, and there in the courtyard perhaps was Moses and Aaron, ready to be consecrated as priest, ready to begin his role. And there's Moses. He has the garments perhaps over his arm. He has the anointing oil in his hand. And he has the headdress ready to set upon his brother's head, ready to make him the high priest of Israel. And it's obvious to everyone who's watching that scene that here is the one man that God has chosen to bear that responsibility of salvation, of atonement for the whole nation. On his shoulders will rest that responsibility. And it's obvious to everyone that this is the one that God has appointed. So that's the first thing. Here's the one that God has appointed. The second thing is that Aaron, as Moses helps to fit the clothes on him, as he bows his head and Moses, first of all, anoints the oil, pours the oil on his head and then sets that turban, that mitre, upon his head. Aaron just graciously accepts that, and he has accepted this great responsibility upon his shoulders. So there are two things that Jesus in verse 10 is doing. Well, first of all, we see that God has appointed him for this work of salvation. He's the agent who God has specially selected for this role, and also Jesus has accepted that role. He's taken those garments upon himself, and he's going to go through that with that role and fulfill it. Here it is expressed in a quote from a book. To be clothed with the garments of salvation is to be commissioned and fitted to be Saviour. To accept the clothes stands for self-commitment to the task. Well, that's all very fine, isn't it, as we just imagine in our minds as Moses helps his brother Aaron into the priestly clothes, the clothes of the high priest. But for Jesus, it involved a lot more than that, didn't it? What was the price of his acceptance? His acceptance of this role of salvation on our behalf? I want you to turn with me to Hebrews chapter 5. This really explains and amplifies this thought for us. Remember those two twin ideas. Here is the high priest of God's appointment, and he's accepted that role. He will take it upon his shoulders to do whatever it takes to bring salvation to his people. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 4. If you just quickly scan the preceding verses, you'll see it's about the high priest, this role of high priest. Hebrews 5 verse 4, and no man taketh this honour unto himself, the honour of high priest, but he that is called of God, as was Aaron. So it's by God's appointment. So also Christ glorified not himself to be made an high priest, but he that said unto him, Thou art my son, today have I begotten thee. He was appointed by God. Verse 7, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications, with strong crying and tears from him that was unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard, in that he feared. It was difficult for him to shoulder this responsibility. It didn't come easily. There was the cross to go through. There was all this pain and suffering. But yes, he would still go through with it. Verse 8, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. He suffered greatly for our sakes, and being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him, called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Here's our high priest. He's taken on that role for us. Back to Isaiah chapter 61. how did he take on this role? How did he view it? It was such a great responsibility. Did he have to grit his teeth and just go through with it because that was God's will? Was that how he felt about his role? That wasn't how he felt at all. Verse 10 again. These are the feelings of our high priest, the Lord Jesus Christ. He says, I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God. Or as one translation, I think it was the NRSV, just that last phrase, my whole being shall exult in my God. My whole being shall exult in my God. He took on the task with feelings of great joy. He loves his people and he was willing to do anything for them, to give his life for them, to bring them salvation. That's our high priest. That's how he felt about his role on our behalf. Continuing in verse 10, God has clothed him with the garments of salvation, etc. Two-thirds of the way through the verse now. He hath clothed me as a bridegroom decketh himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorneth herself with her jewels. We have introduced the figure of the bridegroom and the bride. Often this verse is explained, and I thought so myself as well. We have two characters here, the bride and the bridegroom. Christ is explained as being the bridegroom, and his ecclesia, a third party in the verse, as being the bride. Well, I don't think that's right anymore. I don't think that's how the verse can be read comfortably. There is no third party in this verse. Let's just read it again and get the flow of thought. I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robe of righteousness, just like a bridegroom wears that priestly headdress to his wedding, and just like a bride adorneth herself with her jewels. In some way, an aspect of the bridegroom applies to Christ, and also, surprisingly, an aspect of the bride is applied to Christ in this verse. Perhaps an unusual way to see it, but that is how the verse reads. So in what way is Christ like the bridegroom, and in what way is he like a bride? Let's just put the second of these quotes up. Speaking of a bride and his bridegroom, as their garments proclaim to all that they are bridegroom and bride, and announce their commitment to marriage, so with the same care the Lord has fitted his anointed one for the saving work. So it speaks of commitment and care. I'll also explain it in my words, just to try and get the point across. In what way was he like the bridegroom? And the special feature, the distinctive feature about this bridegroom, and I suppose this was a tradition in weddings at that time, was the bridegroom stood there and he had this headdress on, much like the high priest of Israel used to wear. That was the distinctive feature about the bridegroom. What does that tell us? What is that trying to tell us? He hath clothed me just like a bridegroom wears that on his wedding day. What is that telling us? Three things. First, as he stands there like that, he is accepting his role as head, as husband, as head over his bride. That's the first thing. He accepts his role as head. Secondly, he makes his vows to her on that day. And he makes his vows to love, to honour, and to cherish her. In terms of Ephesians 5, he was willing to lay down his life for his bride. And a third thing that I think this tells us, just like the high priest, his responsibility is to direct her attention to the things of God, to direct her attention Godward, which is perhaps telling us some of the lofty principles we should see in marriage. So there are those three things about the bridegroom that definitely apply to Christ. The bride is probably the more unusual one. We don't often think of Christ in terms of a bride. How on earth can he be like a bride, as the verse says, adorned there with her jewels? How is he like the bride? Well, she spent many, many days ever since her engagement preparing for this moment, for this particular day in her life, when she wants to present herself to her bridegroom particularly, but also to the others who will be watching the wedding. She wants to present herself in the most beautiful and attractive way, doesn't she? And so there's a lot of care and attention and preparation gone into this single moment, this single day. All that care and attention. And that same thing was true of Christ. Right up until the start of his ministry, Jesus was being carefully prepared and groomed for his role that he would take as Saviour once he had matured, once he was ready to start his ministry. So I think the aspect seen there is the preparation, the careful preparation of the bride. That also applied to God's Saviour, his anointed one. So let's just summarise where we've come so far. Here's God's chosen one. He's been given a momentous task. It's the salvation of his people. And he accepts it. He's brimming. He's overflowing with joy and enthusiasm because he loves his people. He loves his God. And he wants to unite them together. Another thing, verse 11, he is absolutely certain of its success. Just like the earth brings forth her bud and the garden causes the things that are sown in it to spring forth, just as that is true, so Adonai Yahweh will cause righteousness and praise to spring forth before all nations. Those are his own words, aren't they? So he's sure that it's just absolutely certain that these things are going to come to pass. And also in 62 verse 1, he says, "For Zion's sake I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness." He's totally committed and dedicated to bringing all of this to pass. There's not a moment when he rests and ceases from this work. He's just so committed to that work. And that's our high priest, brethren and sisters. If you, like me, feel inadequate at your shortcomings at some stages, as I'm sure we all do, well, it's just a wonderful blessing that we have a high priest like that, of such wonderful character and commitment. And he will make up for all of our shortcomings as he intercedes on our behalf before God. He will make up the lack that we feel so often in our life. What a wonderful high priest he is. So we come to verse 11. This is the second reason for his rejoicing, I suppose, his rejoicing of verse 10. Another reason is because he is sure the task will be fruitful. In fact, the verse says his work will be enormously successful. Just read the verse carefully. "For as the earth bringeth forth her bud, and as the garden causeth the things that are sown in it to spring forth," they don't just grow a little bit, they absolutely spring forth and explode with growth. "So Adonai Yahweh will cause righteousness and praise to spring forth before all nations." It's enormously successful work. Did you notice where his work took place? "For as the earth bringeth forth her bud, and as the garden causeth the things that are sown in it to spring forth." There are two areas where his work was concentrated. First of all, there was the garden, the little plot of land that was especially worked, given special care and attention to, and it was even sown with seeds. And as the garden causeth the things that are sown in it to spring forth, special attention was given to this little plot of land, and it sprouted forth with all its growth. So that was one area. The other area, "For as the earth bringeth forth her bud," just plain old earth in general, not given any special attention. but it has its own latent powers of growth, and that's now realized to the full. I think it's talking about Israel, both natural Israel and Israel of the Spirit, as being the garden. That's where God has particularly concentrated his energies, specially cultivated ground. But at this time, the earth too, it hasn't been especially worked, but the Gentiles at large will also respond and bring forth their bud. Areas that haven't been especially worked will be fruitful as well. I want to see the work of this verse 11 as a continuation of the work of one man. It's not just the work of Christ that achieves this, the last phrase of the verse. So Adonai Yahweh will cause righteousness and praise to spring forth before all nations. Practically, how is that achieved? How does righteousness and praise spring forth before all nations? Is that just the work of one man as he gradually moves through each country in turn and preaches the gospel to it? Is that how this verse works? I don't think it is. I'll explain why. If you come back to chapter 59, verse 20, there, of course, is the first song of the anointed conqueror. Verse 20. And the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, saith Yahweh. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith Yahweh. My spirit that is upon thee, the anointed one, and my words which I have put in thy mouth shall not depart out of thy mouth, nor out of the mouth of thy seed, nor out of the mouth of thy seed's seed, saith Yahweh, from henceforth and forever. So it started with one man, isn't it? But it radiates forth. It goes to his seed and then to the next generation and so on. The work is perpetuated. In fact, if you come to Isaiah 61, verse 9, you'll be able to see this perhaps a little bit more clearly. This idea of the work being perpetuated in his disciples. And their seed shall be known amongst the Gentiles, and their offspring amongst the people. All that see them shall acknowledge them, that they are the seed which Yahweh hath blessed. Their seed shall be known amongst the Gentiles. They're in there. They're not concentrated in Jerusalem. They're spread throughout the whole world. They're amongst the Gentiles. They're amongst all the peoples. And they're continuing the work of Isaiah 61, verse 1. Preaching the good tidings to the meek, getting more and more people to respond to the work. So I think the way that righteousness and praise springs forth before all the nations is due to this work of his saints. They have been saved by his priestly ministration, and now they themselves act as priests amongst all the nations in furthering the work of salvation, getting more and more people to respond, until in verse 11 it seems like every single corner of the world is touched by this saving work. Everyone has heard of the gospel, and many people respond with joy to it. They're not reluctant to respond anymore. Just tuck that idea away. I hope I've explained it okay, but we will need it again later. Well, we now come to the next chapter, 62, verse 1. For Zion's sake, I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest until the righteousness thereof go forth. That's actually the same word as spring forth, which occurred twice in verse 11. Go forth is the very same word. Until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, and the salvation thereof as a blazing torch, says Rotherhams, I think it is. A blazing torch seemed to capture my imagination more than a lamp that burneth. So he works tirelessly on our behalf. He's determined to bring God's plan into effect. He's determined to spread the gospel before the whole world and bring in this glorious age of righteousness and praise. He's determined to do that. It's just like Hebrews 12 verse 2, where it says he is the author and finisher of faith. He's begun the work and he will make sure that it comes to completion. The author and finisher of faith. And his aim is to make Jerusalem a beacon which shines out and proclaims righteousness and salvation to the whole world. It's like, in the middle of the verse, brightness. And the salvation is like a blazing torch. It's unmistakable. You can't miss it. If someone walked in here with a blazing torch, I guarantee that everyone's eyes will be drawn to the flame, to the bright light. Nobody in the world can miss the things that are emanating and radiating from Jerusalem. It's very dramatic. It's all-pervading in its effect. Nobody will be ignorant of the new principles that are going forth and emanating from Zion. That's a stark contrast to today, isn't it? And this light that shines out of Zion will be a stark contrast in the darkness of the world. Nobody really wants the terrible things that are experienced in this world. I'm sure that in our heart of hearts, almost every creature on this earth knows the darkness of sin and death and experiences the horror of it in some way. Well, at this time, they will see the light shining from Jerusalem, and for the first time, perhaps, for many of them, it will be clear to them where they should look, what they should turn to in life, and how they should spend their energies. It's clear to them now that God does exist, and they want to learn about his laws, everything that's going forth from Jerusalem. And the effect is worldwide. Verse 2. And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness, and all kings thy glory. The Gentiles, common people, both common people and important dignitaries, will be persuaded to come to Zion. Out of curiosity, they will want to come and see this new phenomena that's appeared in the earth, to find out what makes this strange people to them, these immortal beings, what makes them tick? What are the principles that they live by? What are these laws that they live by? People will be curious and eager to come to Jerusalem. Common people, even important dignitaries, like the Queen of England and such like. John Howard from Australia. If he's still there, I suppose. Anyway. Verse 2. In the middle of the verse, well, let's start from the beginning again. And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness, and all kings thy glory. And thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of Yahweh shall name. What's this new name that Jerusalem will be given? Is it perhaps like that city in Turkey, which used to be called Byzantium, until Constantine came along and changed its name to Constantinople? And then later on, to the present day, it became known as Istanbul. Is that what this is talking about? In the kingdom, will Jerusalem be known by some other name? Is that the point of this verse? I don't think that is what it's telling us. Jerusalem today, what does that conjure up in your minds? It seems to be the source of never-ending violence and antagonism between Israel and the Palestinians in particular. But there are others who stake a claim to that city. So there's all the violence to start with, and all the bloodshed that goes on in that city. If you think back in history to when the Turks ruled Jerusalem, it wasn't really a very taking place. They just let the land go to waste, and all around Jerusalem, instead of beautiful fields and orchards like it could have been, they just left it go to waste, and there were stones. It was just nothing special at all. So Jerusalem, for a long time, has never really conjured up wonderful images in people's minds. But this will all change when Yahweh shall name it with a new name. I think that's the idea. It will have a new status. People will see Jerusalem in a different light. Verse 4 will help explain. Thou shalt no more be termed forsaken, neither shall thy land any more be termed desolate. Instead of speaking of all those things to the world, violence, destruction, bloodshed, terrorism, instead of that, Jerusalem will speak of the word of God, of immortal beings who are there as priests. They will think of the temple of Yahweh, which is there on Mount Zion. All these wonderful things. That's what Jerusalem will conjure up in people's minds then. And notice who achieves this transformation. It's a name which the mouth of Yahweh shall name. Despite sincere and very well-meaning efforts, no human being has been able to solve this vexatious question of Jerusalem. Who does it belong to? No one can actually solve that question apart from Yahweh. He will achieve the transformation. And a radical transformation it is. Let's move on to verse 3. Note the wording of verse 3 very careful. Where do you wear a crown normally? A crown goes on your head. And a diadem, which is another form of head covering, that also goes on your head as well, obviously. Now, verse 3. Where are those things? Thou shalt also be a crown of glory in the hand of Yahweh, and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. What is it talking about here? Why is Jerusalem like a royal crown, a royal diadem? And why is it in the hand of God? Surely a crown ought to be worn on the head. What is the verse telling us? Here's another quotation which I think helps. Zion is not said to wear, but twice over to be the crown or diadem in the Lord's hand. To be in his hand is to be kept, guarded and upheld. To be a crown is to be that which expresses kingliness, not the exercise of royal power, that's the wearing of a crown, but this is the possession of royal worth and dignity. The Lord's people will be the sign that he is king. And the second quote, the surprising picture here is that the Lord holds his people as the sign to the watching world that he is king. So the crown held in God's hand shows that Jerusalem now possesses royal worth. It's something valued by God, something precious to him. Hope you're fast writers if you're writing that down. So Jerusalem possesses royal worth and dignity. It's a precious gem in God's eyes, something that he treasures. I want to note something about that word diadem. You see, whilst a crown relates to a crown is what a king wears, the diadem is more priestly in its function. In fact, the word is only used a handful of times, and I don't think it ever relates to a king. It always relates to a priest. So a crown is kingly, a diadem is priestly. But it said it was a royal diadem in the hand of God. So in that phrase, royal diadem, the ideas are twinned together. Kingship and priesthood. What's that saying? How is Jerusalem like that? How is Jerusalem kingly and priestly at the same time? Sorry about that noise. It's kingly because Jerusalem will be the seat of rulership of government. That's where people will come for their justice and judgment. That's where the edicts and laws will proceed from. That's where Christ the King and his saints will sit and rule. That's how Jerusalem takes up the crown aspect. What about this priestly aspect that's expressed in the term diadem? How is Jerusalem priestly in its function? Well, Jerusalem is the place that nations will flow to. Jerusalem will be the gateway to worship God and to have fellowship with him. The temple of Ezekiel itself will be there. So whilst people can worship God in all their little corners of the earth, they will have to, at least once a year, come up to Jerusalem, because that Jerusalem is especially the gateway to worship and fellowship with God. That's how it's priestly in its role. Jerusalem will be a priestly city in that regard. One other thing from this verse that I found very touching. See if you find it touching as well. Let's very carefully read verse 3 again. Thou shalt also be a crown, Jerusalem, of glory in the hand of Yahweh, and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. Thy God? So, despite all the turmoil that has existed in history, despite the distance, the gulf that has sometimes existed between God and his people, as they've been punished for their sins, as the city's endured siege and all kinds of other things throughout their history, it's different now, isn't it? Thy God, Jerusalem's God. There's a sort of affection between people and God. There's a close bond between them. This same idea in some other verses. Chapter 61, verse 6. Israel's privileged position as priests among the nations. But ye shall be named the priests of Yahweh. Men shall call you the ministers of our God. That's the Gentiles speaking there. And they regard Yahweh as our God. There's a much closer relationship between the two, isn't there? Verse 10, I will greatly rejoice in Yahweh. My soul shall be joyful in my God. Of course, there is that close relationship between Messiah and his God. 62 verse 5, for as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee. And as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over me, thy God. And verse 12, they shall call them the holy people, the redeemed of Yahweh. They have a special status. They are the redeemed of Yahweh. He has made them what they are. He has forgiven their sins. He has given them immortality, and they are recognized as the redeemed of Yahweh. He's given them that unspeakable gift, which they couldn't have achieved in their own right. Oh yes, I think there is now a very close bond and a warmth of feeling between the two parties that didn't always exist in the past. Verse 4. Thou shalt no more be termed forsaken, neither shall thy land any more be termed desolate, but thou shalt be called Hephzibah, and thy land Beulah, for Yahweh delighteth in thee, and thy land shall be married. I don't know if this will change much for you, but I really liked a literal translation of the first bit of the verse. It read like this: no longer will forsaken be said to you, and to your land no longer will be said desolate. I suppose you can get the same understanding from the Authorized Version, but it just seemed to capture the imagination in my mind. No longer will forsaken be said to you. Why not? Because the past is so completely forgotten that people don't even think about it. People don't remember the past because they see this glorious present and future which Jerusalem now holds. People don't even think about those things anymore. They don't remember the past in any way. Forsaken? Desolate? Jerusalem isn't seen as that at all. She will be called Hephzibah and Beulah. An interesting thing about those names, it's most probable that those were actual people living at the time that Isaiah spoke. Hephzibah definitely was, because he was Hezekiah's wife, and the reference is 2 Kings 21 verse 1. Beulah is the one which I suppose there must be some uncertainty about, but tradition says that Beulah was actually Isaiah's daughter. So these names had special relevance to people living in Isaiah's time because they actually saw Hephzibah and Beulah walking around the city. And I'm sure that they would have been prominent women, well-known women. How could the wife of the king not be known to the people? How could the daughter of the major prophet in Israel at this time hide in the background? I think they would have been well-known amongst the nations. So that's very interesting, I thought, that these were actual people. But the point is the meaning of their names. You'll see in the margin, in your centre margin, against Hephzibah, it says, "My delight is in her." That's what the name means. And of Beulah, also in the centre margin, that means married. So we're back to the theme of 61 verse 10, of marriage. So instead of forsaken by God, she is now delighted in by God. And instead of being desolate, I suppose the streets of the city after a captivity, there would just have been this eerie echo as there was nobody there. The streets were empty, desolate. There was nobody in the land. That's how Jerusalem once was at times throughout its history. But that wouldn't be true anymore. She would be called Beulah, married, with the fruit of her loins there, young children and more mature children running around her feet, so to speak. Just so completely reversed. So instead of lonely isolation, Jerusalem is now the object of delight, devotion and joy from a loving husband. And instead of an empty city and a wasted land, she is now a hub of activity, teeming with all her children around her feet. It's a wonderful thought, and it continues into verse 5, which must be one of the worst places that the translators could have put, end of paragraph mark, because the thought continues right through from verse 4 into verse 5 with some delightful imagery, as Jerusalem is now loved by both God and her own sons. They rejoice in her. Verse 5, "For as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee." Why didn't it just say, "For as a man marries a woman, so shall thy sons marry me"? Why did it have to say, "For as a young man marrieth a virgin"? Couldn't we get the same idea? Why did it include the term young man and virgin, which is a young woman, I suppose, isn't it? Why does Isaiah use that language? Well, I think the thought captures our imagination. It speaks to us of the vitality and enthusiasm of youth. As a young man and a young lady come together, they are to be married, and they have all their dreams. They chat excitedly about how they will spend the rest of their lives together. They love to plan their future together, and they see themselves as spending a whole lifetime together in joy and happiness as they share life together. And that's how Jerusalem's sons, the people who live in Jerusalem, feel about their city now. They're just delighted, bubbling over with enthusiasm that they will have eternity to now spend together. And the last half of the verse, "And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee." So God himself has this same unity, this same love, tender loving care over Jerusalem and its people. There's a unity of mind there. There's true companionship between God and his people. "As a bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride." That's talking about God and his people. True companionship and fellowship together. Come to Revelation 21, verse 2, please. God himself sharing fellowship with his people. Can it really be true? This is talking about an intimate relationship that exists between them. Revelation 21, verse 2. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. It's the same idea. What an exciting thought that is. God himself being with them. Just find my next overhead. It's a little quote. Slightly larger than this. So this is really summarizing the metaphor of verse 4 and 5 together. In metaphor, we see a woman, once bereft of husband and children, seemingly faced with the bleakest of futures. But now she has become the object of genuine delight to a loving husband who nourishes, cherishes, and values her with all his tender loving care. Now on her horizons, only exciting prospects appear. She is celebrated for her beauty and is adored by her large family from all corners of the world. What an absolute transformation in fortunes for that city lies in store. It's almost unbelievable as we look at the situation today, but it will truly come to pass. So where are we? We're up to verse 6, aren't we? I have set watchmen upon my walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace, day nor night. Ye that make mention of Yahweh, keep not silence. I have set watchmen upon thy walls. Who set them there? The anointed one has actually put them there. And he must have done that by the work of chapter 61, verse 1, when the spirit of Adonai Yahweh was upon him, because he had anointed him to preach good tidings to the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, etc. Verse 3, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion. He gave them hope out of their hopeless situation in the meek, the downtrodden of the world, those who are brokenhearted, those who are captives in a far-off land, and those who languished in the dark prisons. He gave them hope. He set them as watchmen upon his walls, and told them about the glorious time that was coming for Zion. And they took that on board. And they burned with enthusiasm. They longed for the time when these things would be realized. And they sat there on the walls of Jerusalem. And they still sit today, calling to God for this time to come to pass, asking him to hasten the day. It's interesting, isn't it, that they have the same passion and zeal for Zion as the anointed one himself. See verse 1. For Zion's sake I will not hold my peace. That's exactly like these watchmen that he set on the walls of Jerusalem. So remember verse 11 of 61. Just as they continued the work of the anointed one in spreading the gospel to all corners of the earth, so they have the same zeal, the same passion, the same intensity of feeling about Zion as their master, as their Messiah. Verse 6 and 7 actually run together. The very last word of verse 6, keep not silence, is actually the same word as verse 7, and give him no rest. You'll probably be able to see that from your margin. This is how the RSV translates the last part of verse 6 and the first of verse 7. Ye who put Yahweh in remembrance, take no rest and give him no rest. Take no rest, that's the end of verse 6. Give him no rest is the start of verse 7. So it runs the idea together and it helps to build the intensity of the two verses. It builds the intensity of feeling. So here are these watchmen. upon the walls of Zion. And they're never silent to their God. They're always crying to him for these things to come to pass. And they give him no rest until he will do this. That's really all they care about in life, isn't it? They couldn't care for the things of this life. All they care about is Zion. They used to mourn, verse 3 of 61, for Zion. Used to mourn in Zion. And that is their life's desire. That is all they care about in this life. They couldn't care about a house and a car and all the things that this life has to offer. All they care about is God's purpose. All they want is his kingdom to come and to be redeemed by their Redeemer. Chapter 61, verse 1. They were the meek anyway. Life had nothing to offer them. They were at the bottom of the pyramid of society. Chapter 61, verse 1. They were brokenhearted. This life had nothing to offer them apart from disappointment and despair. Utter dejection. There was nothing in this life for them. They needed something else. They needed something beyond this life. They were only pilgrims and strangers. They were the captives in a far-off land. They felt like they were in a prison. And that's why they so longed for the New Jerusalem. They really understood the gravity of their situation, and they wanted to be out of that. Their whole focus, their entire being, was fixed on Zion. Come to Hebrews 11, verse 16. This is exactly the same thought in Hebrews 11, verse 16, the chapter of the faithful. And we must see ourselves amongst those faithful. I'm sure everyone would agree that they want the kingdom to come. They feel the same sort of thoughts as those watchmen. Everyone here tonight would truly in their hearts want the kingdom to come. Hebrews 11, verse 16. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. How do we fit the bill as some of these watchmen? Are we truly one of those who the Anointed One has set? For I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem. Have we been set there by Christ in our life? This is what those watchmen were like. Single words that describe their attitude in life. Ceaseless, vocal, in harmony with their God. Their thoughts are totally in harmony with him. They're disciplined. They see this need as urgent and pressing, and in their zeal for it, they're sustained. They don't just sort of burst forth for a few days and then forget about Zion. It's sustained throughout their lives. Let's just... expand those things. Expand is the word. Ceaseless. So this word ceaseless, this captures the idea that these things of the kingdom are never far from their minds. Even though they might go to work and be at their desk all day, whatever they do, their mind is never far away from the things of God. The sort of spirit that David embraces, he was never far away from godly thoughts, was he? It was always in their mind. A bit like the verse in Thessalonians which says, pray without ceasing. Where did I get that from? Ceaseless. I have set watchmen, verse 6, upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace, Rotherhams, all the day and all the night. All the day and all the night. Ceaseless. It's never out of their minds. They're never thinking about other things. This is always in their mind. They never hold their peace day or night. They aren't just thoughts. But those thoughts are expressed to God as they vocalize them in their prayers. They actually converse with God in their prayers and speak to him about the issues that burn deeply within their hearts. Ye that make mention of Yahweh, your marginal help, make mention of Yahweh, is better translated, ye that are Yahweh's remembrances. Where did that RSV quote come? Ye who put Yahweh in remembrance. So they're always reminding Yahweh about his principles. Not that he needs reminding, not that he forgets about those things. Of course he doesn't. But they show that their minds are in harmony with their God. What God cares about is what they care about. They're in tune with their God. Ye that make mention of Yahweh, keep not silence. It's not as if by reminding him that they can bring the day of the kingdom forward. That's not true at all. But they just show by their attitude that they want the kingdom to come. Obviously, reminding God isn't for his sake. We can't benefit God by reminding him about his kingdom. But the benefit is for us. What's the fourth thing? Disciplined. Where did I get that from? I can't remember. Ah, yes. The end of verse 6. Ye that make mention of Yahweh. What did the RSV say? I just feel it's a better translation for you. Give him no rest. No. Take no rest and give him no rest. Sorry, I'm just getting very confused. And I'm probably confusing you in the process. Let's start again. This idea of being disciplined in prayer. It's something that is a set pattern, like, think for example, Daniel. He prayed 3 times a day. He had those set times for prayer, and he always prayed with his face for Jerusalem. We should be like that too. Take no rest and give him no rest. It's a discipline sort of thing, is prayer. We can't just do it on the spur of the moment. Well, we can, but it's wise to have a set program in place, isn't it? Rather than think, oh, let's pray now when we feel like it. It's wise to have a set program in place. And also, this idea of being urgent and pressing. It really does burn within their hearts, doesn't it? Give him no rest until he establish and until he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. So it really is all they care about. It's the most urgent thing on their mind, the most pressing need for themselves. And finally, it's sustained over a lifetime. I think we mentioned this at the start. Give him no rest till he establish and make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. So it's something that is sustained throughout life. Well, I messed that up a bit, but I hope you're able to follow me after a fashion and get most of those points. Sorry about that, everyone. Now, we're up to verse 8. And we seem to be doing okay for time, Uncle John. We might get some questions in there. Verse 8. Yahweh hath sworn by his right hand and by the arm of his strength, surely I will no more give thy corn to be meat for thine enemies, and the sons of the stranger shall not drink thy wine for the which thou hast laboured. But they that have gathered it shall eat it and praise Yahweh, and they that have brought it together shall drink it in the courts of my holiness. So there's this oath given in verse 8. Yahweh hath sworn by his right hand and by the arm of his strength, surely I will no more give thy corn to be meat for thine enemies, and the sons of the stranger shall not drink thy wine for the which thou hast laboured. Security is promised. Let's just put a quote up. The top one. Loss of crops to an invader was a common pre-exilic experience, and it would have spoken deeply to Isaiah's people about their coming security to be told that this would never happen again. In fact, it was in their recent experience, wasn't it, when Sennacherib came down and overwhelmed their nation like a flood until only Jerusalem was left. The floodwaters had risen right up to the neck. That was in their recent experience. They knew what it was to lose their crops and their vineyards to an invader, I'm sure. They'd felt the pain of that. It's fresh in their minds. But now, this is confirmed with an oath. This will never happen again, that type of thing. And it's confirmed, not just by the oath, but by his right hand and by the arm of his strength. I think the idea of that, the hand and the arm, is that Yahweh has graciously given this provision of security. And if needs be, he can enforce that with the arm of his strength. I think that's the ideas expressed by hand and arm. So God is a gracious giver, and he has the power to ensure that security for Israel. That idea of the crops and vineyards being lost comes from Deuteronomy 28. No need to turn there. You remember that chapter is about the blessings that would ensue for obedience and the curses that would come for disobedience. Well, they would lose their crops to their enemies if they disobeyed, but they would have security. That was a blessing promised if they obeyed. So there's a hint here at the close relationship that now exists between God and people. And that's confirmed in verse 9. But they that have gathered their produce shall eat it and praise Yahweh. The eating of these things goes hand in hand with praise to Yahweh. They understand his provision for them, the security that he offers. And they that have brought it together shall drink it in the courts of my holiness. There is intimate fellowship expressed here. And the people understand and recognize Yahweh's provision for them. Let's look at this other quote. The secure plenty that the people enjoy, verse 8, is accompanied by an unclouded intimacy with the holy God. It's a beautiful picture. God and his people together, at one with each other. Their sins and iniquities are remembered no more. Well, verse 10 brings a bit of a change in Isaiah's description, his language. He's been bubbling along nicely enough, I suppose, over these two chapters. But now the excitement builds in verse 10. He reaches a fever pitch of excitement. And you can see this by his doubling of the words. The technical term is double imperatives, if that means anything to you. But it helps to build the intensity that Isaiah is feeling. Verse 10, go through the gates, prepare ye the way of the people. Cast up the highway, gather out the stones, lift up a standard for the people. And in verse 11, three times comes this word, behold. Behold, behold, behold. If someone walked up to you and said, look at this, and look at this, and look at this, you'd gather that they were fairly excited about something, wouldn't you? Well, that's how Isaiah is feeling in verse 11. Capture the idea of the excitement that he is feeling. Why is he feeling this excitement? Because this is a very special set of verses to him. This is a magic moment for Isaiah, because this is when Christ and his saints appear on the scene. And he was really excited by that. That was the thing that really captured Isaiah's imagination. And he commands a flurry of activity in verse 10. As people are coming from across the world, he ushers them through the gates. Go through the gates into Jerusalem. The gates are flung wide open and he ushers them through. And more people are coming on the horizon. There are many more people coming together. And he realizes that the roads need to be improved and built up. The word cast up Better translated, build up, build up. So he's opened the gates of the city. Everyone's told to move through the gates. And he also commands his workers to prepare the way of the people. Make sure that the highway is nice and smooth. Build it up if necessary. Remove all the stones that might impede people's progress. And set a big flagpole in Jerusalem so that people know where to come. Verse 11. This is the reason for all that flurry of activity in verse 10. Behold, Yahweh hath proclaimed unto the end of the world. He's got a message which goes to every corner of the world. Say ye to the daughter of Zion, behold, thy salvation cometh. The whole world is told that Zion's salvation is coming. What would the whole world care about Zion's salvation? And also they're told, behold, his reward is with him and his work before him. Whose reward? Well, this is obviously the anointed one. And his reward and work are his saints. Isaiah 53 will help you. You know where it says in Isaiah 53 verse 11, he shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. His people are his reward and work. They are what he's worked for, they are what he's achieved now in salvation. Yes, verse 11. Most translations, in fact, just about every translation that I looked at, says this. Oh, I've just lost the verse. It's verse 10, not verse 11. Go through the gates. Prepare ye the way of the people, singular. Cast up the highway. Gather out the stones. Lift up a standard for the peoples, plural. Just about every translation did that. And I can't tell myself, but I just have to trust that that's right, since the weight of evidence was there. So it's talking about people singular, that is Israel's sons, Israel in the flesh, and also the Gentiles who are coming. Now, why would it interest them, people from all places of the earth, why would Zion's salvation interest them? People from Japan and places like that, Mongolia, would they be interested in Zion's salvation? Argentina? The ends of the earth. Why do they have an interest in Zion's salvation? Why do they respond to this invitation? And why do they all flock to Zion? Well, it's simply because bound up in Zion's salvation is their own salvation. Micah chapter 4 verse 1. I'll just read it out to save a bit of time. It'll take a long time to find it. No, I found it. But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of Yahweh shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all people shall flow unto it, and many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. Their interests are now in Zion because they see that their salvation is dependent upon Zion's salvation. They're bound up together in it. And very quickly, verse 12. And they shall call them the holy people. This is how the Gentiles view the people of God. They shall call them the holy people, the redeemed of Yahweh. They recognize salvation and redemption for what it is. They're beginning to grasp all the concepts of the truth. They can now see the virtue of holiness. They're beginning to grasp what redemption is all about as they see these people who have been redeemed in front of their own eyes. They're able to mingle amongst immortal beings. So they really are beginning to come to terms. They're beginning to grasp exactly what the truth is about, what God is offering in Zion's salvation. And thou, Jerusalem, shalt be called sought out, a city not forsaken. People will now flock to Zion because that's where Yahweh may be found. A literal translation, because apparently the word forsaken is in the perfect tense. This is what the literal translation ran like. She will certainly never be forsaken. Sought out, a city not forsaken. She will certainly never be forsaken. It just seems to underline the definiteness of this thing. So in conclusion, what have we seen tonight? Well, this is a section of Isaiah which describes the glorious future that God has in mind for the world. Some of the highlights for me personally: to see Messiah, so overjoyed about his role in our salvation, just bubbling with enthusiasm because he wants to save us. He wants to bring us into the kingdom, to be the author and finisher of our faith. Another thing was his total dedication to his fulfillment. Despite our own inadequacies, we have a wonderful high priest to rely on. With a wonderful work ethic, he just will not rest until that day comes. And on our behalf, he intercedes for us. We won't make it because of our own righteousness. We all know that. But our high priest will make up the difference. He will get us across the line. Another thing that I enjoyed seeing was the prospect of this intimate fellowship with God. God himself being with us, with his people. And the close relationship that now exists in this time between God and his people. And another thing was the unbelievable transformation in people's thinking worldwide. And their eager responsiveness. Remember, the garden sprang forth with activity. People will be so receptive to hear about God's ideas and laws. A real contrast to what we see in the world today. So that's the third song of the Anointed Conqueror.